Welcome to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. On today's program, we'll hear an article from the Intelligencer. You'll hear a piece from the Braille Monitor about Louis Braille. And we'll begin with this piece from the ARC entitled, What's Happening at the Social Security Administration? Here's What People with Disabilities Need to Know. Published April 2nd, 2025, by Jackie Dilworth. Millions of people with disabilities rely on Social Security benefits to survive. Recent changes at the Social Security Administration, SSA, may make accessing these benefits harder than ever. Long wait times, office closures, and staff cuts, and policy roadblocks are already raising concerns and exacerbating customer service issues. Here's what you need to know. What is Social Security and why does it matter? Social Security provides benefits to over 73 million people, including over 11 million people with disabilities. It offers financial protection for individuals and their families when a worker retires or dies, or when someone has a qualifying disability. Many people with disabilities depend solely on their Social Security or Supplemental Security Income, SSI, benefits, and related health coverage for their basic survival. Supplemental Security Income, SSI, helps people with disabilities and older adults who have little or no income and financial resources. SSI provides modest monthly benefits to help with basic needs like food, clothing, and shelter, averaging around $714 per month. In most states, recipients automatically qualify for Medicaid, which provides essential health care. Social Security Disability Insurance, SSDI, provides benefits to workers with qualifying disabilities and their families. It also provides access to health insurance coverage from Medicare. A related benefit called the Disabled Adult Child, or DAC benefit, provides income support and Medicare coverage to adults whose disabilities began before they were 22 years old. A growing crisis, long waits and delays. Even before recent changes, SSA was already struggling with long wait times and backlogs processing applications for disability benefits. Every year, thousands of people die while waiting for a decision on their disability benefit application. In April 2025, over 1 million initial disability claims are pending, nearly double the number in 2019. The average wait time for an initial disability decision is 230 days, nearly 8 months. If an applicant is denied and requests a hearing, they can wait another 450 days, 15 months, meaning some people wait over 2 years for a decision. These delays have real consequences. People with disabilities who can't access the benefits they need risk financial hardship, homelessness, and worsening health conditions. In 2023, 30,000 people died while waiting to access Social Security benefits. Staffing cuts and office closures. In 2025, SSA has announced a dramatic reduction in staff and offices, including plans to cut 7,000 employees, over 12% of the agency's workforce, closure of 60% of SSA's 10 regional offices, reducing key staff that help resolve problems with people's benefits, closure of SSA's Office of Civil Rights and Equal Opportunity, which handled reasonable accommodation requests and managed the agency's civil rights complaints, including public complaints of discrimination on the basis of disability. This office's statutory responsibilities have reportedly been divided and moved to other divisions within SSA. Why does it matter? SSA workers process disability applications, answer calls, and help people navigate complex benefit rules. With fewer staff and the consolidations of regional offices, wait times could get even worse. The loss of key staff also raises concerns about SSA's ability to modernize, maintain, and improve essential services, further limiting accessibility for beneficiaries. Modernizing SSA's operations requires long-term investments in systems and processes that are being undercut by these changes. New barriers and policy rollbacks. New barriers and policies that harm beneficiaries are also being implemented, including overpayment collections. SSA can now withhold 100% of a person's monthly SSDI check if they were overpaid, even if the overpayment was not their fault. This means someone's SSDI benefit could suddenly be reduced to zero, leaving them unable to pay rent or buy food while the overpayment is collected, or they request a waiver or alternate repayment plan. We spoke to KFF Health News about this issue in late 2023 and advocated for the pro-beneficiary policies that are now being rolled back. SSI exemption. SSI beneficiaries are exempt from this policy change and still have a 10% default withholding rate. Digital identity proofing. Starting April 14, 2025, millions of people applying for benefits and changing their direct deposit information will now be required to use an online digital identity proofing tool to verify their identity. Those who are unable to complete these processes online will be required to go to an SSA field office to verify their identity in person. Only applies to new applications for retirement, survivors or auxiliary, spouse or child benefits, and direct deposit changes. This new identity verification policy only applies in two situations. One, when someone applies for retirement, survivors, or auxiliary, spouse or child benefits. And two, when any Social Security or SSI beneficiary asks the Social Security Administration to change the bank account that their benefits are deposited into. You do not need to contact Social Security or go to a field office to continue your monthly benefits at your current bank. More information is available on the SSA website. Implementing digital identity verification without significantly improving in-person services will be especially burdensome for older adults, individuals who do not have reliable internet access or a smartphone, those that require assistance using online services, and those for whom online SSA services are not available. For example, there is no online application for survivors' benefits. This will also significantly disadvantage beneficiaries living in rural communities who have to travel long distances to reach in-person services. Disability hearings impacted. SSA is closing some hearing rooms and has reportedly canceled some disability hearings because they could not use agency credit cards to pay for sign language interpreters or translators. This could create even more delays for applicants. How this affects people with disabilities. To be clear, as of April 2, 2025, Congress and the administration have not directly cut the benefit amounts that current Social Security recipients get each month, and they have promised not to cut Social Security benefits. The ongoing disruption at the SSA will likely impact access to benefits, which can amount to an indirect benefit cut for both disability applicants and current beneficiaries experiencing problems with their benefits. It can also create an environment in which errors and benefit delivery interruptions may be more likely to occur. All of these changes have serious consequences for people with disabilities in the short term and long term. Application delays reduce benefits. Many Social Security benefits are calculated based on the date people apply. Delay accessing these vital benefits can result in lower overall benefit amounts for Social Security disability beneficiaries. Benefit interruptions. Disability beneficiaries already experience interruptions in their benefits for many different reasons, especially if they're working. These changes at SSA could make benefit interruptions more frequent, longer, and more difficult to resolve. Longer wait times for benefits. These changes at SSA will likely increase the backlog of people waiting for a decision on their disability application. We are concerned that these longer wait times mean more disability applicants will die before they can get the Social Security benefits they need and deserve. Harder to get help from SSA. Cuts to staff and resources make it more difficult to get assistance from SSA on the phone, online, and in person. We have heard reports of 5-hour-long hold times for SSA's 1-800 helpline, brief outages of the My Social Security online portal, temporary glitches displaying incorrect information about beneficiary payment status on online accounts, and month-long wait times to get an in-person appointment at an SSA field office. Any changes to how SSA operates can be incredibly stressful for people with disabilities who need Social Security benefits to meet daily needs. For this reason, it is imperative that SSA be transparent about the changes they are making and the rationale for these changes. False claims about Social Security fraud also undermine trust in the system. What can you do? If you or a loved one relies on Social Security benefits, here's some information to keep in mind. Please note that this is general information, not legal advice. Due to the complexity of the system, the assistance of a lawyer can be helpful for resolving problems with your application or benefits. How to request casework assistance from your member of Congress. If you need help resolving an issue with your Social Security benefits or dealing with SSA, you can get help from caseworkers in your member of Congress's office. Members of Congress cannot override decisions made by a federal agency, but they can often intervene on a person's behalf to answer questions, find solutions, or help ensure you receive a fair and timely response to your problem. Different offices have different ways of handling casework, so it's helpful to start by calling your member of Congress and saying, "I am a constituent requesting casework assistance with a Social Security benefit. What is the best way for me to submit this request?" They may give you a phone number to call, an email address to contact, or refer you to a form on their website to start the intake process. Be prepared to sign privacy release forms allowing staff to view personal information, like your Social Security number, in order for them to assign a caseworker to handle your case. They will also ask for copies of documents relevant to the issue they are helping you with. Other practical tips. Keep records. Getting and maintaining Social Security disability benefits requires providing records related to your educational, medical, financial, family, and work history to SSA. In recent weeks, outages and other glitches impacting online My Social Security accounts have also become more frequent. Calls to SSA. When you call the SSA helpline, 1-800-772-1213, keep a record of the date, name of the person you spoke to, what you asked, and what they told you. If the information you received does not make sense, sounds incorrect, or is not helpful, you can ask to speak with a supervisor. Mail from SSA. When you get mail from SSA, promptly open, read, and keep a copy of it. Sometimes mail from SSA includes instructions and a deadline for something you need to do. Documents you submit to SSA. Make copies of all documents you give to SSA. Keep copies of the forms you fill out, other materials, and the date you sent them to SSA. Your Social Security record. If you are more than 18 years old, you can access your Social Security records online through a My Social Security account. Download and keep copies of your records from the site, including your statement, your benefit verification letter, your tax form from SSA, your earnings record, your benefits and payments, which shows the date and amount of your next payment, screenshots of any error messages or information pertaining to your payment status that appears to be incorrect. Be proactive. Avoiding overpayments. Try to prevent problems with benefits before they arise by reporting any changes that could impact your benefits to SSA as soon as possible. Examples of things to report include changes to your contact information, address, disability or health condition, marital status, parental status, employment status, income, who you live with, and financial resources over $2,000 for SSI beneficiaries. Setting up a My Social Security account. If you are an adult receiving Social Security or SSI benefits and you do not already have a My Social Security account, it's a good idea to set one up so it is available whenever you need it. SSA is increasingly encouraging people to use online services. Setting up an account will help you get easier access to information about your benefits. Beware of scammers. We are concerned that the rapid rollout of the digital identity verification tool could provide an opportunity for scammers to impersonate the SSA and harm beneficiaries. Remember, SSA will never text, message you on social media, or email you to ask for money or personal information. Know your rights. Information on your rights as a beneficiary or applicant are available on the socialsecurity.gov website. If you receive an overpayment notice, you can appeal, request a waiver, or request a different repayment plan. You are not alone. Social Security disability beneficiaries can do everything right and still run into problems due to mistakes from SSA or other complexities in the system. It can be discouraging, frustrating, and anxiety-inducing. Please know that you are not alone. The problems at SSA are bigger than any one person. That's why we're working together to make the system better for everyone. Share your story. Personal stories help highlight the real impact of these changes. If you've been affected, consider sharing your experience with advocacy groups like the ARC. The ARC is fighting for you. At the ARC, we are committed to advocating for policies that strengthen, not weaken, Social Security. We are working with Congress and disability rights organizations to push for oversight, protect Social Security programs, prevent harmful cuts, and improve access for those who need it most. We also continue to advocate for an increase in the SSI asset limit, which for nearly 40 years has been stuck at just $2,000 for individuals and $3,000 for married couples, far too low to get by in today's economy. The ARC has been a champion of Social Security for half a century. We played a key role in the creation of the Supplemental Security Income Program to help build financial stability for people with disabilities. Today, we serve as co-chair on the Consortium for Constituents with Disabilities Social Security Task Force, working to protect and update these vital programs. Now, an article from the April edition of the Braille Monitor entitled Lewis Braille, More Anniversaries Ahead, by Philippa Campsie, from the editor. Philippa Campsie is a Toronto-based researcher studying the people and events surrounding the invention of Braille in France in the early 19th century. In 2016 and 17, she was given access to the papers of Charles Barbier at the Association Valentin Huy and in the archives of the National Institute for Blind Youth in Paris, the latter being the school where Lewis Braille studied and later taught. In 2021, she published her findings in Disability Studies Quarterly. She has graciously contributed this article to the Braille Monitor as an expression of gratitude for the posting by the Jacobus Ten Broeck Library of Lewis Braille's 1829 book. Her research contains insights that enhance, and in some cases correct, what we believe we know about Lewis Braille and his development of the Braille Code. In the National Federation of the Blind, we celebrate Braille at every opportunity, and this article makes us aware of some of the milestones in its history that might otherwise go unnoticed. Here is the article. The year 2025 is celebrated in France as the anniversary of the invention of Braille. In the United States, 2024 was designated as the anniversary year, allowing for 2 full years of celebration. Mind you, these years represent only the beginning of the adventure that is Braille. There are many other milestones that call for celebration. What happened in 1824-1825? Lewis Braille turned 16 in January 1825. He had been at the Institution for Blind Youth in Paris for 6 years and had spent more than 3 of those years experimenting with a form of raised point writing developed specifically for the blind by Charles Barbier, adopted by the school in 1821. The groundbreaking concept came with something equally precious, the tools that Lewis used to create his own method. Barbier donated dozens of sets of these tools to the students. Barbier's method had been adopted mainly because it was easy to learn and allowed the students to take notes, something that had not been possible for them when raised print letters were used at the school. That was a huge advance for the students' education, but the method took up a lot of space and it did not include symbols for mathematics or music. Although it is often said that Barbier's method was phonetic, it existed from the beginning in an alphabetical form. Letters between Barbier and the director of the school indicate that students used the alphabetical form. Of course they did. They knew the alphabet and they knew how to spell. Why would they bother to unlearn what they already knew in order to use phonetic spelling? And why would the school, which promoted conventional literacy, have allowed, let alone encouraged, them to do so? In Lewis Braille's experiments with Barbier's code, the eureka moment must have been the point at which Lewis realized that dots represented a binary form of communication. Like modern computer code, each position could be 0 or 1, off or on. The lack of a dot in a certain position was as significant as the presence of a dot. This insight is at the heart of the Braille code, every bit as crucial as the 6-dot cell. This year's celebration marks this fundamental achievement. The first publication of Braille. It took Lewis another 4 years to work out the details and get his ideas into print with the publication of his book, whose English title is Procedure for Writing Words, Music, and Plain Song Using Dots for the Use of the Blind and Made Available to Them. Thanks to the National Federation of the Blind, the result can be seen online with French translation and English translation at https://nfb.org/images/nfb/publications/braille/the-first-publication-of-the-braille-code.html. That publication was a huge step forward, and we should mark the occasion in 2029. Unfortunately, the first publication had one drawback: the use of dashes in numbers, punctuation, and musical notation. The dashes were hard to create and hard to decipher. And here's where we see another aspect of Louis Braille's genius. He didn't give up. Where others might have considered the task of eliminating the dashes too daunting, Braille stayed the course. He spent 8 more years creating a dot-only method, the basis of the universal system we have today. The 1837 publication breaks new ground. Unfortunately, the 1837 edition of his procedure is not yet available online. Although it is called a second edition, it is a wholly different publication and a testament to Braille's ingenuity in the way he managed to use 6 dots for everything that needed to be expressed. I hope that the 1837 edition can be posted online well before the 2037 celebrations get underway. The second edition is also noteworthy for features that were not in the 1829 publication. For example, it demonstrates the use of Braille in Latin, German, Italian, Spanish, and English. The book used the Lord's Prayer in these 5 languages to show that the method could be multilingual. In this way, Louis himself opened the path to international adoption years before the rest of the world began to pay attention. In the 1837 publication, Louis, who was by now 28 years old, also introduced a new approach to abbreviation. The 1829 edition had included a version of speed writing that Braille called stenographic, but the 1837 edition offers a slightly different approach. Louis writes, "One should put only the letters strictly necessary for the pronunciation of words. This sounds like a phonetic form of writing. In fact, Braille's abbreviations went beyond phonetic spelling to tightly condensed words. For example, he suggests eliminating vowels that follow consonants, turning the French word vérité, truth, into VRT. As for Braille's 1837 method for music notation, it was so successful that when a new director banned the use of Braille at the Paris school where Louis was now a teacher, Braille music notation still had to be used because there was no workable alternative. Students were in the strange situation of having to use raised lettering for lyrics along with Braille notation for the music itself. A victory for the Braille method. The official ban lasted 4 years. In 1844, when the grand new school building was officially opened, Braille was there to see his method demonstrated and reintroduced. Of course, most of the students had been using it in secret all along because there was no other way for them to write notes. But we can still celebrate the victory of Braille over prejudice in 2044. A final anniversary will be 2052, 200 years since the death of Louis Braille. In 1952, his remains were transferred from the graveyard in his hometown of Coupevray and taken to the Pantheon in Paris to be interred with France's greatest statesmen, scientists, writers, and artists. He belongs in their company. The year 1852 also saw the first institutional adoption of Braille outside France, in Lausanne, Switzerland. A mere 15 years after publication of the definitive edition of his work, Braille's method was beginning to spread internationally. Those are the main anniversaries within the lifetime of Louis Braille. The adoption of Braille around the world offers many other years to celebrate, in many cases a different year for each country. Braille's journey from insight to practical success. We need to recognize that the invention of Braille was not a one-time event, a single burst of inspiration by a 16-year-old that led to a new form of writing once and for all. We like our heroes to be young and their achievements to be spectacular. Louis Braille's genius, however, was to persist in the face of early problems with his invention and resistance to the use of his code. That is what we should celebrate this year and in 2029, 2037, 2044, and 2052. Before beginning our next article, let me remind you that this is the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Our next article comes from The Intelligencer, and it's entitled, "Then They Came for People with Disabilities. The Right-Wing Effort to Roll Back Civil Rights Finds a New Target," by Sarah Jones, published April 3, 2025. In 1959, a teenager, Kitty Cohn, was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy. The daughter of a well-off military family, she discovered that her disability often worked against her family's wealth and political connections. She attended five different high schools, including the posh Holton Arms School, where her cousins had to carry her up the stairs so she could attend classes. At the Mount Vernon Seminary in Washington, D.C., the headmistress imposed certain rules on Cohn. She had to bathe in her house mother's bathroom under the supervision of an adult, even though she couldn't get out of the unwieldy tub. She improvised and began taking baths in her dorm suite on her own power, but that was considered disobedience, she would later say. She also walked down to the hockey field, another infraction. The school expelled her, a decision that humiliated her even though she didn't think of it as discrimination, and neither did the law. The world outside the Mount Vernon Seminary was hardly more progressive. Public schools could, and often did, force students with disabilities into separate classes, regardless of their abilities. Businesses were not usually accessible to them, and employers could refuse to hire them. Many were forced into institutions where some were sterilized against their will. Cohn came of age in a society that preferred not to think of her at all, or when it did, sought to wipe her out altogether. But Cohn, a gay woman in a wheelchair, never surrendered her expectations or her humanity to anyone. By the time President Richard Nixon signed the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 into law after vetoing it twice, she had become a professional organizer, and she would soon join the fight for disability rights. Section 504 of the Act barred publicly funded entities from discriminating against people with disabilities. Yet, by 1977, the federal government had not developed the regulations that would allow it to fully implement the law, which forced activists to take dramatic measures. That April, they launched nationwide sit-ins at the offices of the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. Cohn and roughly 100 other demonstrators occupied HEW's regional office in San Francisco for nearly a month, an effort that may have failed were it not for the participation of Brad Lomax, a member of the Black Panther Party who had multiple sclerosis. The Panthers kept the demonstrators fed, covered the protests in their official newspaper, and paid for Lomax and his attendant to join Cohn and others in Washington, D.C., where they confronted top HEW officials. "We will no longer allow the government to oppress disabled individuals. We want the law enforced," the prominent disability rights activist Judith Heumann told one representative. HEW Secretary Joseph Califano Jr. signed the regulations in the following weeks. Lomax died a few years later, and as one contemporary would later tell the New York Times, "I don't think that all of his aspirations were fulfilled, even after the demonstration. He really wanted more." So did the disability rights movement. In 1990, more than 1,000 activists descended upon Washington to demand passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which banned discrimination in employment on the basis of disability and expanded protections for the disabled in most areas of public life. After a speech, many climbed out of their wheelchairs or cast aside their assistive devices to pull themselves up the steps of the Capitol. The Capitol crawl was strenuous, and activist Jennifer Keelan Chaffins remembered years later that she had to stop several times so she could ask for water. Her mother, Cynthia, was arrested the next day as part of a mass demonstration in the Capitol Rotunda. The ADA passed shortly thereafter, and President George H.W. Bush signed it into law that July. In a speech, he cited the Civil Rights Act of 1964, adding, "Today's legislation brings us closer to that day when no Americans will ever again be deprived of their basic guarantee of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." 35 years later, the Trump administration has disability rights in its sights. The eradication of so-called DEI programs has already reduced accessibility for people with disabilities, as the White House itself made clear in an announcement earlier this month. Trump, it said, had signed a memo removing the diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility precept concerning tenure and promotion within the U.S. Foreign Service. Last week, the Department of Justice removed 11 guidelines that helped businesses comply with the ADA's public accommodations requirement. Though the requirements are still in effect, and Trump cannot overturn the ADA by fiat, the news is a warning. The president doesn't have the constitutional authority to dismantle the Department of Education either, but he's ordered the firing of thousands of workers. I don't think most Americans recognize how much the Department of Education does for disabled students, Jess Davidson of the American Association for People with Disabilities tells me. Many of the fired workers handled civil rights investigations, and, Davidson says, without them, disabled students will fall through the cracks and potentially suffer abuse. Trump claimed earlier this month that Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who heads the Department of Health and Human Services and who incorrectly believes that vaccines cause autism, would now oversee special needs and all of the nutrition programs and everything else. Nobody knows what exactly that means, and Trump may not either, but students, parents, and activists all fear cuts to services and the erosion of basic protections that are guaranteed by laws like the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. As the ACLU warned in a recent explainer on its website, without the department to enforce these protections, millions of students who rely on IDEA for necessary accommodations, such as specialized instruction and assistive technology, are at risk of losing access to the education they are legally entitled to receive. Millions of Americans who cannot work due to their disabilities receive Social Security benefits, and they, too, are under threat. Cuts to the Social Security Administration have already led to crashing websites and long wait times as seniors and people with disabilities struggle to reach workers about their benefits. Some field offices have closed, and workers told the Washington Post that they often don't have the time or the staffing necessary to process complicated benefit cases with any efficiency. Millions of people with disabilities also rely on Medicaid for health care coverage and in-home care, but proposed spending cuts by Republican lawmakers would jeopardize that lifeline. Even Section 504 may be in danger. 17 Republican-led states sued the Biden administration last year, arguing that updated Section 504 guidelines distorted federal law in order to define gender dysphoria as a disability. The truth is more complicated, says Allison Barkoff, a law professor at George Washington University who helped update the policy. Although the preamble to the new regulations say that gender dysphoria may be considered a disability based on a 2022 ruling from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, the updated rule itself does not mention the condition, a fact that Republican states have ignored in favor of a sweeping demand. They went on and said, "Declare Section 504 unconstitutional," Barkoff said. It's really breathtaking. The lawsuit is on pause for now, she adds, but the states have not dropped it either. Though the Rehabilitation Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act had bipartisan support and were signed by Republican presidents, it's hard to imagine Trump signing either piece of legislation. A more ruthless strain of conservatism always percolated within the party, and now it dominates and threatens the protections that Cohn and Lomax and so many others once fought to win. At risk is the concept of civil rights itself. By the time I was born in 1988, Section 504 had been in place for over a decade, and the ADA wasn't far away. When I began suffering from severe depression at the age of 15, it occurred to me dimly that my Christian high school should help me. My parents are conservative, but they sent me to a real psychiatrist. The school was less amenable. When teachers or classmates talked about depression at all, it was to say that any teenager thus afflicted should depend on prayer and preaching, not medication or psychology. The school later expelled me despite my clean disciplinary record, and I could hardly believe my bad luck. I thought my brothers and sisters in Christ would care for me no matter what was going on in my brain. I had never heard of Cohn or the disability rights movement, but the expulsion radicalized me in its own way. This, I thought, was discrimination. After my expulsion, I ended up at a public high school. There, I had something called a 504 plan, or a set of accommodations undergirded by the Rehabilitation Act, which gave me extra time on assignments and the ability to leave the classroom for short breaks. I was able to graduate and go to college, but I chose a Christian university, and when I was diagnosed with a genetic blood disease during my junior year, I realized that I didn't want to tell anyone on campus. I'd grown up hearing about Joni Erickson Tada, a popular evangelical author and speaker who became a quadriplegic after a diving accident and who campaigns against abortion rights, embryonic stem cell research, and IVF. If she was the model, my prospects were limited. I could only be a mascot, not a person. It is a truism to say that the anti-abortion movement wants people like me to be born and will not care for us after the fact. But the argument lingers because it is mostly accurate. I could not pray my way out of a genetic disease. I found no spiritual meaning in it whatsoever. Instead, I had material needs, and the conservative world I lived in told me I had no right to need anything at all. Not health care, not paid sick leave, not even a high school education. Some conservative Christians profess what they call a consistent ethic of life, which calls for a more robust welfare state in addition to bans on abortion. But they have always been outliers, often within their own churches. Religious schools like the one I attended can discriminate against disabled students because evangelicals lobbied for an exemption from the ADA. They wanted and won the right to bar children and adults with HIV or AIDS from their daycares, schools, and sanctuaries, a carve-out that applies to anyone with a disability. Then there was the matter of finances. Evangelicals, sounding much like secular business owners, said it was simply too expensive to make churches and religious schools accessible to people with disabilities. The idea that disabled people might need too much, cost too much, and drain resources better allocated elsewhere is much older than the fight over the ADA, and it has not always been limited to the right wing. Years on, the bipartisan popularity of that basic concern gives it staying power. When Nixon signed the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, he spoke of the need for fiscal discipline and self-sufficiency. In 1977, Cohn and her fellow activists learned that Carter officials had not yet implemented Section 504, in part because they feared the expense. They believed the regulations just went too far, she said in an oral history collected in the late 1990s. evangelicals would thrill later to the compassionate conservatism of George W. Bush, who said that the government should have an active role in American life while cutting the very taxes that helped fund it. To Bush and his allies, economic efficiency and benevolent social policy were not inherently at odds, but even their limited vision of charity would soon fall decidedly out of fashion within the GOP. The Tea Party gunslingers had no interest in compassion at all. In 2015, the year Cohn died, Trump was taking over the GOP, and a decade later, the efforts of conservatives like Erickson Tata, who lobbied for the ADA, almost look quaint. The day belongs to Trump, who reportedly once said of the disabled, "The shape they're in, all the expense, maybe those kinds of people should just die." A commitment to laissez-faire economics does not make a person a social Darwinist by default, and the term has been popularized by critics to discredit various economic and social theories over the years of its popular use, as the scholar Robert Bannister observed. No one calls themselves a social Darwinist either, not even Trump's lieutenant Elon Musk, but the latter's obsession with efficient public spending and the heritability of IQ provoke bleak comparisons. The historian Richard Hofstadter argued in 1944 that American businessmen saw in Darwin's theory an opportunity to justify the widespread inequality that enriched them. They had wealth not because of exploitation or greed, but because they deserved it. If the fittest are to be allowed to survive, if the benefits of efficient management are to be available to society, the captains of industry must be paid for their unique organizing talents, Hofstadter said. Those attitudes persist into the 21st century. After Trump first took office, House Republicans introduced a bill that would have made it more difficult to sue businesses for violating the ADA. It failed, but the party wasn't finished. Later the same year, Republicans attempted to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act with a bill that would have provided weaker benefits to people with pre-existing conditions, which sparked dramatic protests from members of ADAPT, a disability rights group. That bill failed too, but it belonged to a trend. Keelan Chaffins, who participated in the Capitol crawl, said in 2020 that, "I kind of feel like we've stepped backward a bit." And her mother added that people just kind of feel like they don't have to comply with the ADA anymore. During the height of COVID, Republican politicians and conservative billionaires like Tim Dunn of Texas urged the Trump administration to prioritize the economy while, in Dunn's words, allowing the at-risk population to take extreme precautions with support from their communities, not the government. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce complains that abusive ADA lawsuits unfairly penalize small business owners. In most states, it's still legal for businesses to pay disabled workers a sub-minimum wage. The re-election of Trump brought us DOGE, and as Elon Musk and his young engineers search for fraud, they spin a familiar tale. Where there is need, there must be waste. Musk has claimed falsely that millions of dead people are receiving Social Security benefits. Kathleen Romig, the director of Social Security and Disability Policy at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, tells me that the Social Security Administration's payment accuracy rate is over 99%, and when errors do happen, they're often caused by paperwork delays. Disabled people who receive benefits aren't living in luxury either. Many fall into the poverty trap, which happens when the rules of a program inhibit a person's opportunities either to work or to otherwise get out of poverty, Romig explains. To qualify for Supplemental Security Income, an individual with disabilities is subject to an asset limit of $2,000. And the moment you go over $2,000, if you have $2,500 in your account or something, you lose access to your whole benefit, she adds. The asset limit has not been updated since 1989. I think it is very much a poverty threat because there's a lot of research now on how having at least some kind of financial cushion or an emergency fund can really help your situation from spiraling out of control and keep you at a subsistence level of existence, she says. Social Security and Medicaid are popular with voters, but the disabled among them remain vulnerable to the GOP's social Darwinists. Zoe Gross, Director of Advocacy for the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, says that Medicaid cuts could threaten the program's home and community-based services, which often covers personal and home care for people with disabilities, depending on the state. Most people don't want to live in a residential or institutional setting, Gross explains. They'll be cut off from their communities, she says. There's more abuse in those settings than in community settings, and you just lose a lot of autonomy and choice in your life if you're put in a residential setting. That independence is now at risk. So if states get a big Medicaid cut, like a cut to how much the federal government is giving them to spend on Medicaid, the first place states will cut their own Medicaid spending is HCBS, she adds, which would jeopardize one of the most important services the government provides autistic people. The Medicaid cuts, as proposed, may fund tax breaks for corporations and wealthy households, which the left-leaning Economic Policy Institute recently described as the clearest legislative priority of the Trump administration and the Republican congressional majority. There are moral implications to any economic policy, and the abrogation of basic rights and care would plunge millions into uncertainty. ASAN, in a bid to prevent that possibility from coming to pass, is lobbying members of Congress against Medicaid cuts and the Trump administration's mass layoffs of government workers. We're also doing a lot of work to try to empower our community to get more involved in policy, Gross says. The organization is creating plain language guides that explain complex policy topics and offers guidelines and scripts that help autistic people contact their representatives. A lot of autistic people struggle with speaking on the phone or may not be able to speak at all, she says. So ASAN provides proxy calling where a person will craft the message they want to deliver and a volunteer places the call for them. Phone calls are really prioritized over emails and text-based communication in terms of just how Congress works, she explains. That's the way that we're trying to make sure that all of our grassroots can have their voices heard. Hours before I spoke to Gross, the Washington Post reported that RFK had hired David Geer to lead a new government study into the debunked link between vaccines and autism. Geer was disciplined by Maryland regulators in 2011 for practicing medicine without a license, which has not stopped Kennedy from citing his dubious research as part of a crusade against vaccines. But Geer's problems are far more extensive than his retracted studies. He and his father, Mark, who lost his Maryland medical license in 2012, built a laboratory in their basement and injected autistic children with a prostate cancer drug for years, a treatment they falsely billed as a cure. The fact that this person has been appointed to run this study just shows that they're going to really put their thumb on the scale in terms of the results of this study, and that's going to be terrible for vaccine hesitancy in this country, and people will die as a result, Gross tells me. Yet the Trump administration and its supporters deny the stakes of their policy. By eliminating DEI, they are defending merit. By elevating Geer or Kennedy himself, they make America healthy again. when they use slurs, they simply exercise their free speech, and anyone who objects is a snowflake. Musk says he is autistic, but he likes to call his critics retards, and he is not alone. As one anonymous banker told the Financial Times last year, "I feel liberated. We can say retard and pussy without the fear of getting canceled." Slurs are more than hot air, and Musk uses them to reinforce a revanchist strategy that is as material as it is semantic. Disabled Americans already had to worry about the poverty trap, and now a far-right billionaire wants to kick millions off the socioeconomic ladder into darkness. That he does so while complaining of anti-white bias is no coincidence. Black Americans are likelier than white Americans to have a disability, owing to structural inequalities that Musk and the Trump administration are poised to exacerbate by design. Lomax, a black disabled man, spent much of his short life fighting a version of America that is not so distant. To the right wing, DEI is less white fragility and silly posters about white supremacy culture than it is the mere presence of a woman or non-white person or disabled or transgender person in any high-skilled, high-status position, Jamel Bowie of the New York Times wrote. And their alternative isn't some heretofore unknown standard of merit. It is the reintroduction of something like segregation. Today's war on disabled people is part of a much older campaign against civil rights for all minorities. The integration of people with disabilities into American life only became possible through the restructuring of a hostile society. Autonomy for the disabled is not defined by the absence of need, but the pursuit of liberation, which means it is about power. It is, as Davidson of the AAPD tells me, about treating us like human beings. She adds that we deserve to be able to speak for ourselves in whatever way we can, for our essential human nature and human desires, to have control over our lives as much as possible, to be recognized by the world around us. Her comment reminded me of a speech by Cohn, who, after the 504 sit-in, said that activists had written a new page in American history. "We showed strength and courage and power and commitment." Cohn recalled, adding that we, the shut-ins or the shut-outs, we, the hidden, supposedly the frail and the weak, that we can wage a struggle at the highest level of government and win. Perhaps it's time to write another page. And that concludes our program for this time. Thanks for joining us here on the Disability News Program. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader.